And then we'll turn it over to Jim, our speaker captain.
Hey, everybody. I'm Uncle Jim, your speaker captain. And I have the pleasure of introducing to you tonight Carl P., straight out of Oakland. His home group is called the In-Between Fellowship. And, you know, I had to ask him, what does this in-between fellowship mean? Like life and death or drink and no drink? Nope. There's a building in between two buildings, and that's where they meet. I thought that was a pretty cool fact down there in Oakland. Tonight we are privileged because Carl's been with us since 1978, and he's part of one of our very important groups in AA called NorCal H&I. And maybe you might share a little bit about that tonight. But if we could give a big Warm Valley group welcome to Carl P. from Oakland, that would be wonderful and appreciated.
Well, thank you, everybody, and thank you, Jim. My name is Carl. I'm an alcoholic. It's good to see a couple familiar names, and it feels comfortable already. You know, sometimes I struggle with this, partly because my ego tells me to be nervous, but partly because, unlike apparently a lot of people, I don't really remember that much about early recovery per se. Oh, by the way, the In-Between Fellowship, the mythology about it used to be that it was in between two bars, out in East Oakland, but that was debunked, and apparently it was just between two restaurants, and that was about the size of it. But the name endures. And it's an interesting fellowship. There have been known to be bullet holes in the glass in the front of the building, among other things. I had to walk past some crime scene tape to get to a beginner's meeting one night, but it's a peaceful neighborhood these days. And it's my home group because first time I went there, the old-timers greeted me with love and care and concern and made me feel like I belonged right away. And that's what I really remember most about being new. I do, however, remember my last drunk very well. I came to lying face down in a parking lot in San Francisco in the Tenderloin at the end of my, hopefully, last drunk. And it was the coldest night in the history of San Francisco as far as I remember, but I had two nickels in my pocket, and I called the detox wagon, and by God, could tell them where I was and remember the number. They came and picked me up and took me back to the Salvation Army detox and then back up to the Salvation Army facility that I had left to get drunk that last time. That was a long time after my first AA meeting, and I got to tell you, I arrived at my first AA meeting via Napa State Hospital, where a social worker referred me to the Oakland Black Alcoholic Clinic, and it was in East Oakland. I went there. We had a blast. None of us was very serious about AA, but the first AA meeting I ever went to was there, and two guys from Hospital Institution Committee came. And they seemed dull and boring, you know, and they kept telling the same stories. And I complained about that, and someone said, Carl, they're here to tell the truth, not to entertain you. And just a glimpse, sort of what AA is supposed to be about, but I didn't buy into it. Ultimately, a few more trips through detoxes, etc., and I got sober. I began drinking when I was 14 years old. It seemed as natural as could be. I got to tell you, alcohol healed me on the spot that night. It made me feel like a 1,000-watt light bulb burning bright and strong and powerful. And I was king of the world. And I didn't even have a hangover the next day. It was wonderful stuff. And for 18 years after that, I tried as often as I could and as hard to duplicate that feeling with alcohol and other substances along the way. It was Berkeley in the 60s, and we tried a lot of things and did a lot of things. But in the end, I realized I never could get that feeling back. And in the end, it was an anesthetic, and that was all. I didn't realize that I was using it as anesthetic in the beginning to heal my feelings, you know. I didn't know anything. I had no insight, no real purpose. I dropped out of life. The summer I turned 14, I found the pool hall and alcohol. That was it. And I was a ne'er-do-well for years after that. Along the way, I did try to be responsible. I got jobs. I got married. I had a child. Did these things to act like I belonged in society, but never really knew how to fit in. And never really wanted to belong in society. And in the end, alcohol had me so isolated. You know, I was a street bum months at a time near the end there. And that was perfect for me because nobody wanted to be near me. No one asked me for anything. I had no obligations. And I paid a hell of a price for it. It almost killed me emotionally, you know, so isolated and lonely. But I didn't really know that until I got sober, thank God. So that detox wagon came and picked me up and out of that parking lot, and I went back to the Salvation Army. And I've been drinking beer only, by the way. I single-handedly proved the progression of the disease, to myself at least. And I was hallucinating and hearing and seeing things and couldn't eat right or sleep right for probably a couple weeks after that. I'd been physically sober for about 8 months before that last drunk, and 10 days of drinking damn near killed me. It was amazing. And I was only 33, so, well, 32 actually, but when I got back to that Salvation Army place, you know, I looked around one night and I thought, well, I didn't really make a decision to get sober. I just kind of thought, I don't want to keep doing this. I don't want to keep coming back here or have a worse fate. I had been in worse places. I had come close to dying a few times from overdoses. I'd been in drunk tanks, the county jail once, on and off in the streets, had an alcohol withdrawal seizure once, you know. By the time, I was pretty malnourished a lot of the time. I was sick. By the time I got back to the Salvation Army, I had crumbling teeth, no fingernails. The only clothes I had, I got from the Salvation Army. You know, it was a mess. And I'm kind of glad for that low bottom because it forced me to begin at the beginning. And I didn't really have much left to hang on to except pride and ego, which, of course, are the major things I had to get rid of. But so I just sort of made a half-assed decision that I didn't want to live that way anymore. And this guy who'd been coming out there every week for all those months I'd been sober at that place, a guy named Bill, who was part of the hospital institution committee there in Sonoma County, who became my first sponsor, said, well, what do you think? You ready to quit? And I said, I don't know, man. I don't know. After I'd been there back a little while, he asked management at that place if he could take me to some outside AA meetings, and we went to Napa and other places around there. Usually we drove a little way so he could have time to grill me and tell me what's what on there, on the way there and on the way back. And ultimately, he did become my sponsor. You know, and he was so gentle and so loving and so kind. And I remember the first group that was my home group in Santa Rosa, it was called the Smiles Group, and it met at 11 o'clock on Sunday mornings in the detox. And none of the clients were smiling, as I recall, but us AA members were. And now my home group is a Sunday morning old-timers meeting at the In-Between Fellowship, and it starts at 11 o'clock, too. But anyhow, the actual nuts and bolts of early recovery, I don't remember a lot about that, but I do remember what it felt like. We would hold hands after the meeting, and I just felt uplifted. I could feel the spirit and the power of the group and the love of the group. I finally belonged, and I finally started believing that a little bit. And then, you know, I started the journey through the steps with Bill. Excuse me. And step one, it has taken on more and more meaning the longer I stay sober. It turns out that the things I was told the first 30 days to stay sober are the things I need to do now. And it works just as well now as it did then. It's a pretty simple program when it gets right down to it. I had to complicate it a lot along the way before it got simple again. But nonetheless, Bill gently led me through the steps and checked me out on step three, and then one night I wrote out about, I don't know how many pages of everything I'd ever done that I felt ashamed of, guilty about, afraid of, or angry about, and read it to my sponsor, Bill, a couple nights later. And it was a terrifying experience because I thought he would think I was a disgusting human being who wasn't worth talking to and overinflating my own importance as usual. But you know what his total response was? Are you done? Yeah. He said, good, I'm hungry. Let's go get something to eat. I mean, it was just a day in the life of a sponsor to him, you know. He didn't dismiss it, but he didn't want to overreact, I guess. And a few days later, after I did step five with Bill, I got this little feeling in my chest, and I didn't really know what it was. Later, I identified it as hope. And, God, I thought, well, man, maybe I really can do this. I've been sober 8 months or something, and said whatever it was. And then that hope began to turn into faith. And I, you know, went home, took the book off the shelf, did six and seven and all that, and started making amends. And I had some big amends to make. I'd done some horrible stuff to wife, I had ignored my daughter. I'd later paid a price for that. And so I had some amends to make, and but it began with forgiving myself, you know, and that was hard to do. I had been kind of indirectly taught when I was a very little child that I was useless, worthless, and no good. My mother did not love me. And, you know, a small child who isn't loved by their mother will do anything to get their mom to love them, because that's the most important thing there is. And she never did, so I was very frustrated. And I've had to work through all that, you know. And when she got sick and was dying, I rekindled the relationship to some extent. And really looking back, because people were talking about it on Mother's Day, I realized that I actually did forgive her and myself. She had a rough go. She was raised by an alcoholic. She told the story one day of having to appear in juvenile court for my brother and me for two different offenses on the day that her third divorce was finalized. And she was working. When we lived back in Nebraska, she was working for minimum wage to support us. She really devoted herself and had to give her her due, but that ghost pops up in my everyday life to this day. And I'll tell myself I'm no good. I'll start a conversation with an apology when I didn't do anything wrong. I'll underestimate my value one way or the other. You know, the main thing Bill did for me was got me into service almost immediately. He started dragging me to jails and loony bins and prisons and stuff right from the get-go. And I was wet behind the ears, and I had no idea what I was doing. I wound up in Folsom State Prison when I'd been sober about a year with this big AA thing. And I looked around and was scared to death. But, you know, it was a big AA meeting, and it was fine. And it was fun, and it was instructive. And I've been going back to institutions like that ever since. It's the cornerstone of my recovery, as far as I'm concerned, is that kind of service. It's how it was brought to me, and it's kind of how I bring it to others. That's one of the sources of frustration from this past COVID year or plus, is we haven't been able to go into institutions, of course, but that's starting to shake loose a little bit. Even in prisons, just like it sort of is in the rest of society. And it's both exciting and scary and everything else all at once. But at one of my first H&I committee meetings, I met this woman up in Sonoma County I got straight. I left the Salvation Army, moved in with my sponsor, took no chances. I had a job, working in the deep docks, which later developed into a career from which I retired in 2013. That whole thing is an amazing story in itself. But I met this woman, and we fell in lust and then we decided we were going to have a relationship. We later got married. We didn't have children, but we came back to Oakland. You know, we lived in San Francisco for a couple of years, and I got a job in East Bay, and we came back to Oakland in East Bay, which is, I had been from Berkeley and Oakland before then. So I was kind of home. And that's when I started to go to the In-Between Fellowship and stuff. But in 1999, my wife's cancer came back. In 1998, actually. And a year and a half later, in October of 1999, she died on October 18th. I had total hip replacement on October 25th. And I found out a couple months later I had hepatitis C. That was a crappy month. And you know what? I didn't get high. I didn't get drunk. I didn't get loaded. And not because of me being wonderful, because of friends in AA and other friends and loved ones who took care of me. The program takes care of me, man. It has never let me down. It's the damnedest thing. It's not like I deliberately tested. It's just that if you stay sober long enough, you're going to go through things. And hopefully you'll survive with the help and love of the program. As my friend George, who died a few years ago from the In-Between Fellowship, used to say, and he had like 55 years sober when he died, he said, there's only two things you need to do to have long-term sobriety, don't drink and don't die. Now, it's obviously a little more, takes more work than that, but nonetheless, I managed to do that for a while. And 1978, that sounds impressive, doesn't it? I joke about it and say that's a long time between drinks. But when I realize that I do today what I was told to do at the beginning, and that's how I stay sober, and that's how I learn to live comfortably in this world, it really makes sense. And those are things I learned in the program. To take a program a day at a time, to take life a day at a time, to take ups, downs, and all arounds. The vicissitudes of life, as Bill Wilson called them, with a grain of salt. It's just life, and it happens to everybody, and it's unfair for everybody. It's beautiful for everybody, and it can be a joy or a drag for anybody on any given day. Fortunately, most of us aren't having that same crappy day at the same time, so we do survive, because if I rely on the program, it's how I survive. And so I've never stopped coming back, no matter what. I survived all that mess in 1999. And being a widower was easy. Everybody felt sorry for me and bought me food. It took a while. I eventually went back to work. You know, my hip healed and all that. But I used to living alone, actually. But it took a long time to get used to being single. And I didn't even know it. And I didn't know that I really didn't want to be single. But I tried some first dates and this and that, and got really disappointed. So I gave up. You know, I'm going to be a disgruntled, grumpy old man. I'm just going to sit in my easy chair, watch baseball games, and let it go at that. And then, of course, here came this blind date, and we've been together since 2002. And, you know, I mean, how lucky is that, man? I get to be in love with two wonderful women in the same lifetime. It's just, oh man, on a daily basis, that's there. And, it blows me away daily, really, when I'm conscious of it and being grateful about it. You know, the ensuing years with the career and all that other stuff, I mean, it just sort of happened. There have been some downers, in a way. I mean, because I neglected the daughter from my marriage, she and I really don't talk. Later in my recovery, I met a daughter I had from a relationship, well, from having had sex in Arizona in the 60s. And I met my daughter, who was 12 at the time, and we really hit it off. And I got to know her, and I became friends with her mom. I'm still friends with her mom. I'm friends with my other daughter's mom, too, by the way. But so that was really neat. And as she got older, she had some trouble, and my first wife and I helped her through some of that stuff. And ultimately, she got married, and we lost touch. I'm not really sure how. Eventually, she got in touch with me the day her grandmother died. She still had my home phone number, and I still had the same number. And we started a new relationship. Turns out she had three sons, still has them, and my grandsons. And my wife and I became instant grandparents, and we were going up to their house all the time and meeting them at places between their house and our house, and really enjoying the whole trip. And then at one point she got mad at me for, and I still don't really know why, and I lost contact with her in 2008. She refused since then to have any contact with me at all. So I'd love to see my three grandsons. It breaks my heart. I blame myself. I do all of that stuff, but I've learned to live with it. And, you know, I hear stories of loss and horrible things happening to people. And the program seem, you're not, I shouldn't compare, I guess, because it's all relative, but far worse than what's happened to me. And people bear it with dignity and courage and grace and keep asking for help. And that's step two for me, and it's proven to be one of the hardest things ever for me, is to ask for help on a regular basis. And now I'm pretty good at it. I sponsor a couple guys. I have a sponsor. I use the phone a lot. I talk to usually at least one AA person every day. And we shoot the breeze. Ironically, I'm going to more meetings on Zoom now than I had been for a while. I'm going almost every day now, and it's a blast. Zoom is Zoom, but seeing old friends from my home fellowship is really something. Every now and then I reminisce about when I first got to the In-Between Fellowship. There was Big John and Clyde and all these guys who are no longer there, of course, because that was almost 30 years ago, but now I'm one of them. And my contemporaries are the old timers at the In-Between. You know, we just keep flowing along, and the program never dies. The program never dies. And if there are newcomers here tonight, God bless you. Keep coming back. That's the one thing that is really important to remember, no matter what. My sponsor came to his first meeting drunk and loaded. And he'd just been jacked up by the police that night. And all I remembered from that meeting was, try not to drink, Larry, and come back tomorrow. And he did that, and he's been sober 35 years. He never took a drink after that. He didn't have to have the same kind of trip I did to the bottom, but he hurt enough, and then he heard enough to keep coming back. And I don't know why some people stay sober and some don't. I really don't. I've given up making a book on alcoholics a long time ago because I've been wrong every time. I don't know what it is. But I do know people that stick around have a much better chance than the people that don't stick around. You know, it comes to step two and three and my relationship with my higher power. My favorite line in the big book about that is, either God is everything or God is nothing. What's your choice? That's not exactly how it says it, but that's how I interpret it. And I'm going with God is everything because it makes more sense than God is nothing. And by everything, that's inclusive, obviously. It includes you. It includes everyday encounters. It includes nature. It includes everything. You know, and what it does is remind me that I'm here with a purpose. And I didn't get sober just to sit around and brag or run around saying, gee, I'm sober, as if the clerk at Safeway gives a damn one way or the other, as if the average person on the street says, hey, there's Carl Price, he got sober. Ain't that wonderful? Well, you know, some people are really glad. My wife is sure as hell glad. She didn't know anything about AA when I met her, and it was really funny because within a month, she was saying things like, don't you think maybe you should go to one of those meetings? She'd catch me in a bad mood or being a jerk and direct me back to the source. But so sobriety's obviously vital. It's the center of my life. It has to be. It's what gives me life. But it gives me life, and therefore I live. I mean, I do volunteer work. Tomorrow I'll help some seventh graders at a middle school with their writing assignments. I've done that for about 3 years now through this program in Berkeley. For a few years, we couldn't do it, obviously, recently, but I was reading books to 3- and 4-year-olds at a Head Start in East Oakland. Well, that was a blast. That was the best hour of my week. There's nothing like a group of 3-year-olds. They pay attention, man, and they'll mess with you if you make a mistake. And but it's so much fun. It's so much fun and so rewarding. They give back every instant. Today, my wife's colleague brought her 9-year-old twins over today. And I've known those kids since they were born. And you know, they were only here for about a half hour, 45 minutes, but we had a blast. Can we see the garden? Heck yeah, man. Let's, you know. So my life has things like that in it. Parties, people, friends in and out of the program. A couple, an AA buddy and another friend came over, sat on the deck, and we had coffee today. And just talked about various things. Sports, my AA buddy and I talked about, excuse me, about San Quentin, because he's the coordinator out there of the H&I meetings. But it's life. It's participating. It's all that stuff I was afraid to do and didn't know how to do that drinking protected me from. And I'm no expert at living in the world. I'm really naive and stupid and crazy about some stuff. I forget to pause, you know, and I'll jump to a conclusion and find myself just laughing like crazy because I was so wrong. I haven't had to find out the hard way too often, but of course I do sometimes. More likely than not these days, I'll pause when I'm reacting and look at the energy or the feeling that's really underneath. Not at my words, not at the situation, try to, you know, quit blaming other people, places, and things for how I feel, and take some responsibility for what's going on with me. And 9 times out of 10, my feelings are hurt. I feel rejected. I'm having some kind of immature response. And if I can talk about that with somebody or kick it out of myself somehow, then I have a much better chance of responding to the situation in a mature way. As Larry, my buddy Larry says, if you bring a problem to a meeting, it's cut in half. If you bring joy to the meeting, it's doubled. And, you know, I don't talk about intimate details of my life in meetings particularly. I save that for my sponsor, generally, or other good friends. Or, you know what? I've come to trust my wife explicitly and implicitly. I have taken some real chances because she's the person who can hurt me the most on earth because I love her the most, and she doesn't. I've come to really trust her, and that's been a long haul, actually. I didn't realize how difficult that it wasn't a hurdle exactly, but my own level of resistance to fully trusting another human being. AA, Alcoholics Anonymous, is good for me. My higher power represents itself. It sounds like a cop-out to say God is everything, but really, I feel that spirit in a meeting. I feel it in an honest exchange with another person. I felt it with those little kids this morning. How can the Spirit of God not be in that kind of young, vital, vibrant life? And being fully present right now, this moment, today, that's what it's about. I don't know how many moments I'll have. There's a story about a Buddhist story about a young woman who's being chased by tigers. She comes to a cliff and looks down, and there's tigers at the bottom of the cliff, but she sees a little vine sticking out, so she crawls over the edge and grabs the vine. Then she looks up and a mouse is chewing on the vine. Tigers above, tigers below. But she sees a strawberry going. And she picks the strawberry and says, man, that tastes good. So my goal today is eat the strawberry, you know, because there will be one if I look hard enough. And to not predict disaster, to not predict fantastic. fantastic outcomes. And, you know, hell, by the time I was sober 6 months, I envisioned myself speaking in Yankee Stadium to 40,000 adoring fans. You know, come on, man. And I know Bill can relate to that. But the, no one ever given a damn about poor old Carl. You know, never, just like the reality, which is I'm a human being. Some people care about me, some don't. That's how it is for all of us. I got to say, in the beginning, what really carried me away was we had a rowdy group of people that all got sober around the same time up in Santa Rosa. And we actually, there were seven or eight of us, and we actually called ourselves the Bill Wilson Memorial Choir, just to be irreverent about it particularly. And, people did not like us talking about that stuff. You know, these old, straight old-timers. Ah, there's those smart-ass kids again, or whatever they said. And we loved it. We all went to meetings. We all had sponsors. We all did the steps. We all were of service. But we were young smart-asses at the same time. You can do anything you want in AA. You can pretty much find anything you want, and you can become whoever you want to be. Find the grace that's been given you through the steps. I'm not sober because I deserved it or because I earned it. I'm sober through the mercy of a power greater than myself. Through the grace of a power greater than myself. And I've been given this chance to live again. And every day I try to take advantage of that chance. Every morning when I wake up, I say, thank you, God, for letting me be here alive and healthy and sober. And I go from there. And I mean, I can screw it up in the next 5 seconds, of course, but I keep coming back to that basic fact. A power greater than myself is doing things for me that I couldn't do by myself ever. And that's what the help of people can do in many different places and meetings like this. Let's see. I don't know. I ramble a lot, I know, and I don't want to just start making shit up, which I'll do. I'm sorry for cussing and making stuff up. But I'll cut it off there. And actually, Jim said there might be somebody with questions or whatever. I don't know. Oh, thank you very much. Sorry to be so abrupt. Sir, are there any questions or any input or any... I'll leave if you want me to, whatever you want.
Well, somebody usually leads the discussion and the question. Is that Leah?
Yeah.
I don't want to step on any toes here.
You're muted.
Can you hear me now? No?
Yeah.
Okay. Backwards. Okay, so we're going to open it up for questions. If anybody has any questions for Carl, if you can pick the option in your participant option to raise your hand, we'll go in order. Okay, so Oren, you have a question?
Yes, hello everybody, Oren Alcoholic. I just want to thank my creator for another day of sobriety. With that being said, I just want to say, not really a question, but I really liked the way you said, sobriety being part of your center for life pretty much. And I'm coming to find that is a reality of my life today, you know, so I really appreciate you sharing that. It really hit home with me. And thank you. Thank you for your share, and thank you for your inspiration and help.
Thank you, Oren. Keep coming back, man.
Hey, Oren. I'm not Oren. I'm sorry, Carl. Hey, I'm Jim, alcoholic. Hey, I got a question. When you came into AA back in 78, did you have a family that you were coming into with AA, or... were you single? I didn't catch that part. Like, I'm just wondering about your family after you came into sobriety with your family. How did they react to you being part of AA.
Yeah, thanks, Jim. I mean, I have my nuclear family, my brother and sister and mother. My wife and I have been divorced, my daughter's mother and I. And but I was single and lived alone, but was able to reconnect with my nuclear family and with my ex-wife. We did make amends. We had some very tense conversations in the beginning, but we did clean it up. And, you know, at one point she said, look, I was young and dumb, and I was there too, Carl. So she actually was very generous and said, it just wasn't all you. I did some pretty nasty things to her, but eventually we became friends. You know, my brother died from this disease. He had been a heroin addict, and he got clean but didn't stop drinking. And he died from liver cancer at age 51 or something. He had two kids and a couple of grandkids. It was sad. My sister is doing all right. I have a relationship with her to this day. And my mother died in 2008, but as I said, we traveled the journey of forgiveness, and that really made a difference. So I think that answers your question. Thanks.
Bill?
Yeah, hey, Carl, I wanted to ask you a really difficult question, like, who's your favorite guy from Visalia named Bill Hatzman? But I'm not gonna ask that question, because that's just silly. I'm going to ask a different question. It's been my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous that it's really kind of weird, but it seems to me like when I'm willing to let commitments to Alcoholics Anonymous inconvenience me the most, I seem to get the biggest charge out of it. And I know you and I are both, you know, zealots for the hospitals and institutions work. I'm just curious if you might have any stories you might tell our audience about how any of your service commitments or anything that you've done in Alcoholics Anonymous where you might have felt like, this is nonsense, this is a waste of my time, I don't want to do this, and you came away with something that you didn't expect. Do you have any stories like that you can share?
I'm not sure. I, you know, back in the days when I was first sober, we really did do 12-step calls, for instance, and I got a call from the Sonoma County. A person had called and wanted to talk to somebody from AA. And so my late wife and I got in the car and went up to there was a park nearby, and we got out and it was pitch dark. And I started asking, saying the guy's first name. This dude kind of came creeping out from behind a dumpster, and I thought, oh man, this could be it for both of us or whatever. I had no idea what was going to happen. And it turned out that I had a couple of half quarts in the car, which was brilliant on my part, standard in those days. And he just wanted to go to detox, so I gave him a ride. But it was kind of scary, and I thought, what am I doing? This is nuts. But, you know, I got a guy to detox, and I visited him the next day, and I don't know whatever happened to him. Sometimes I think just some of the disorganized stuff that we go through, H&I, I think the California Department of Corrections is absolutely off their rocker sometimes, and I have to deal with a lot of stuff. But in the end, we get to go into those places and take AA meetings in there. Sometimes I'll hear an individual guard say something really bad about inmates, and I have to hold my tongue and not say anything because I don't want AA to get kicked out. Ultimately, the value of AA in any setting is 1,000 times more important than how I feel about it. And I never want to jeopardize AA standing either in the public. I don't want to be a bad representative of AA or in an institution or anywhere else. And I've learned to say yes in AA, inconvenienced or not. It takes precedent because I just was taught that when I was a youngster. I don't know if that answers it much, but there it is.
There's time for one more, maybe? Anybody know? Well, my name's Liam, I'm alcoholic. I was wondering, Carl, if you're familiar with the terminology boomerang when it comes to when they say keep coming back, a little story behind it. And, wow.
Nope. I'm so unhip, it's not even funny, Leah. And you can ask anything about pop culture, about anything modern, and I won't know anything. But you could explain it to me if you want. Maybe I'll get it. What does that? I saw it in the chat, but what does that boomerang stuff mean?
Well, from my understanding, a friend of mine, he's been around for a while, and Albert, he was telling me about how one of them, he had asked one of the first Americans, this was back in AA first started, against like one of the first Americans to actually make a boomerang, because when you throw the boomerang, it comes back. And I guess I incorporated that with the keep coming back. And he was showing me his little medallion. The medallion is a keychain thing, and it has keep coming back on it. And he was telling me a little in the story behind it. Like, so.
Cool.
Yeah. I was interested in more, but.
Thank you. I've been enlightened.
I don't know nothing. All right. So it looks like we have come to the end of our meeting. So we will, we're going to go back to Oren with